Hello, I'm Patrick Byrne. This is number 0442, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0442. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Dennis Palumbo, author of the Daniel Rinaldi Mysteries, has his fifth novel in the series out called Head Wounds. It took 4 years for this novel to come out.
Usually they're about 2 years apart, but this one took a little bit longer. You know, I am a full-time therapist, and I see 40 patients a week, so I don't have as much time to write as I'd like. And I really wanted to get this one right, because for longtime readers, we finally find out what happened to Daniel Rinaldi's wife.
PR specialist Ryan McCormick, who doesn't believe CEOs and celebrities should share their political views.
The moment you take a political stance, we're talking, I support this candidate or I support that candidate, what's going to happen is that you are going to provoke a person of the opposite mindset negatively. And there are people who love the President of the United States. There are people who do not love the President of the United States. When you attack the President, you're polarizing on a deep, deep level a portion of that audience that will probably no longer want to do business with you.
Caroline Frazier is the author of Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Laura lived for a very long time, 90 years, and so her life covered a whole swath of American history. The books only take you up to the day that she got married at the age of 18. So I became very interested in the frontier history behind her life and wanted readers to know more about that because it's just fascinating and in many ways kind of a darker history and more dramatic even than the stories that she told.
And there's lots and lots and lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0442, was Patrick Byrne, author of Double Entendre, The Parallel Lives of Mae West and Ray Bourbon. It's a dual biography of the screen's sex queen, Mae West, of course, and her friend, the legendary female impersonator, Ray Bourbon. It's published by Bear Manor Media. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which Patrick just said, and you'll find links to Patrick's book. There you go. See? Comes all full circle. And thank you very much, Patrick, for doing the guest slate on this program, a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And speaking of Patreon, a Patreon patron shout-out, we have a new patron for the show, David Torito. He owns a furniture store in Montreal called Casa Vogue. You can check out their website at casavogue.ca. And thank you very much, David, for your patronage and becoming a patron of the program through Patreon. Everyone else can do it, too. Tell all your friends, by the way, David, to do the same thing. Thank you very much. There you go. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A truck driver involved in a love triangle was arrested for causing a crash while he was having sex and on crystal meth. According to police in New York, 38-year-old Stephen Walker and another man were doing drugs and having sex in the truck, which was parked near Kennedy Airport. While having sex, the boyfriend of the other man arrived and confronted the lovers. Walker quickly attempted to flee from the jilted man. As he drove off, he rear-ended a woman's silver sedan. She was rushed to a hospital. Walker then crashed into a fence, crushing the cabin of the truck. Walker managed to escape without his pants and hid in an empty horse trailer outside of an animal shelter. After a few minutes, Walker came out of the trailer and spoke with emergency workers about his lover, who was still trapped inside the cab of the truck. First responders were able to free the man, who was naked from the waist down, and they took him to a hospital for treatment. I don't believe this is what the term keep on truckin' was meant to symbolize. I also don't believe the term there are 8 million stories in the naked city is what they meant about New York either. But I digress. Anyway, a U.S. Postal Service branch in Slidell, Louisiana, said a man came in wanting to send a heavy package to an unnamed federal agency. When asked about the package, the man ran, leaving the 70-pound box inside. Postal officials called police, who responded with the bomb squad. Streets were cordoned off while officers figured out what was inside. The conclusion, not explosives, but rather poop. Human excrement. The pooper was found and taken into custody for a mental evaluation. One detective summed up the situation by saying, "I can't make this stuff up." Yeah. You know, there is premeditation, and then there's some serious premeditation. I mean, how angry do you have to be at government officials that you could work that hard and that long to collect 70 pounds of your own excrement to mail to the government? That takes some serious dedication and possibly a high-fiber diet. Anyway, a waterfowl hunter is in stable condition after a dead goose fell from the sky and knocked him unconscious. Robert Mealhammer of Dorchester County was hunting with three other people when one of them fired at a flock of Canadian geese overhead in Easton near the Miles River on Maryland's eastern shore. Maryland Natural Resources Police spokeswoman Candy Thompson said a falling goose hit Mealhammer, knocking him out and causing head and facial injuries. The Washington Post reports that when he came to, he knew who he was, but little else, according to a Natural Resources police officer. The agency tweeted that Mealhammer was in stable condition and awaiting more tests at a Baltimore trauma center. Well, that is clearly a case of karma if I've ever seen one. Also, it was a Canada goose, so I'm sure it said, "Oh, excuse me," after the collision. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, if you've been wondering whatever happened to Barney the dinosaur, then wonder no more. 54-year-old David Joyner, who romped inside the big purple suit for 10 years on the 1990s Barney and Friends show on PBS, well, today he's a tantric sex guru in Los Angeles who says he can unite his client's body, mind, and spirit through tantric massage and unprotected sex. Joyner credits his tantric training with helping him endure the 120-degree temperatures inside the Barney suit. While surprised, Stephen White, the former head writer on the show, says he sees Joyner's new vocation as the "I love you, you love me" deal, but different. "I don't judge or anything, but that's a side of David I didn't know." Wow. You can never hear that song the same way again anymore.
I love you, you love me. We're a happy family with a great big hug and a kiss from me to you. Won't you say you love me too?
Exactly. Yes. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Regular listeners to the Stuff File program already know that one of my favorite writers is Dennis Palumbo. He's the author of the Daniel Rinaldi series of crime novels. His fifth book in the series is just coming out. It's called Head Wounds. In the books, Daniel Rinaldi is a therapist who works with the police. In real life, Dennis Palumbo is also a licensed psychotherapist and a former Hollywood screenwriter. Dennis joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. As I said, I'm really getting excited at the fact that your fifth book in the series is coming out. You take a long time to write these things. I believe it's, what, a little over 2 years since your last one?
I think actually it's closer to four.
Oh, wow. Yes.
Since the last one. Usually they're about 2 years apart. But this one took a little bit longer. You know, I am a full-time therapist, and I see 40 patients a week, so I don't have as much time to write as I'd like. And I really wanted to get this one right, because for longtime readers, we finally find out what happened to Daniel Rinaldi's wife, whether her was, in fact, the result of a mugging gone wrong or actually murder. And it actually turned out to be, I think, the most intense and harrowing of the books. If your listeners like suspense and headlong momentum, this is the book for them.
Well, you just touched on a plot point, the fact that you're going to answer the questions leading to the death, rather, of Danny Rinaldi's wife. When you first wrote this character in your first book, which I guess was Night Terrors?
No, the first book was called Mirror Image.
Sorry, Mirror Image, then Fever Dream, then Night Terrors, and Phantom Limb. Yeah. So when you first wrote about Daniel in Mirror Image, did you know at some point you were going to touch on this plot point somewhere down the line?
No. I had just conveniently gotten rid of his wife for storytelling purposes, and I thought, well, since Daniel Rinaldi, who's an expert on trauma, I wanted him to have experienced the trauma. And so I set it up that he and his wife were mugged. They were both shot. She died. He barely survived. And then for years later had to struggle with survivor guilt, which is something anyone who survived any traumatic experience certainly is familiar with. And so then his mission became, and it is throughout all five of the books, to help those who've been traumatized by violence. That's the consulting role he takes with the Pittsburgh police. But over the course of the first four books, so many readers kept asking me, well, what really happened that night? What was the story with the mugging? And so I decided to answer the question, and it became a very, very intense, layered story. And I'm really proud of it. I think it may be the strongest book in the series, Head Wounds.
Now, as you say, he works with the police department in Pittsburgh. It's a working relationship that's almost a love-hate relationship. They appreciate what he does, don't necessarily appreciate him, and kind of vice...
Yeah, that's pretty much the size of it. The people with whom he works most closely, a detective named Sergeant Polk and another one named Eleanor Lowry, with whom he ended up having a relationship, they have very mixed feelings about his connection to the police. He's been helpful to them, but he's kind of a maverick because he's a consultant, so he's a civilian. He can do things they can't do. But he also, quite frankly, has his own psychological issues, one of which is he's got a little bit of a hero complex. And a lot of people in his life, his family, his friends, think that one of the reasons he gets so involved in some of these high-profile cases is because he feels so guilty about the death of his wife that he kind of doesn't care about the kind of danger he may find himself in. And so I like that. I like the fact that he still struggles with his own demons, but it does give him a very, very significant feeling of a mission for justice. And that's really fun.
In putting out a successful crime mystery thriller series, it's not just a matter of one's imagination and craft as a writer. There's a certain amount of research that goes into doing what you do. So in researching the role of a therapist in connection with a police department, have you had a chance to talk to other therapists who do this? Have you had a chance to talk to police departments who use therapists? Is this a job you've done yourself?
I haven't done it officially. I've done it a little unofficially, but I can't describe it. But I am friends with a couple police detectives here in L.A. who I get to ask questions about. And of course, my own experience, not only as a therapist, but I studied after I got my license, I studied for 5 years in a consultation group with Robert Stallaro, the nation's number one trauma expert. He's the person that, like, if there's an explosion in Tel Aviv, they call him to help the survivors. And so I learned so much about trauma that I wanted to make sure that my psychologist hero wasn't just a psychologist, but a trauma expert, someone who treats the victims of violent crime. And, of course, that also is a perfect way to get a quasi-amateur sleuth involved in cases he shouldn't be involved in.
The stories take place in Pittsburgh. That is your hometown, although you've been living in California for many years now. How do you go about incorporating? Because Pittsburgh really is a character in the stories, at least the previous four that I've read. It's a very vibrant character in your previous stories. How do you keep that part alive? Because as I'm sure you know, you leave someplace for a period of time. It changes while you're gone.
Well, not only does a city change, Pittsburgh in particular has gone through what many people call a renaissance. I mean, when I knew Pittsburgh, it had steel mills and smoky skies, was a very blue-collar town, very industrial, where people from generations before worked at the same job that their parents and grandparents had worked. That Pittsburgh almost no longer exists. All those steel mills are gone. Any steel that they use for these new gentrified places is all imported from Japan, and it's become very white-collar. It's the home of state-of-the-art medicine, state-of-the-art technology. It's where robotics are being revolutionized. And so one of the things, you're right, Pittsburgh is definitely a character in my books. And one of the things that I talk about a lot is how gentrification has changed the character of the town and how my character, Daniel Rinaldi, when he was a kid, it was the old Pittsburgh that I knew. And now it's the new Pittsburgh. So he has a foot in either world, particularly because his dad was so blue-collar. He was a beat cop with the Pittsburgh police. And so Daniel's background is very blue-collar. He's the first one in his family to go to college, to have a profession, to wear a jacket and tie. He really has a foot in both worlds. Pittsburgh is really an astounding place because old and new coexist.
So basically what you're saying is that Daniel Rinaldi himself is like Pittsburgh with literally a foot in both worlds.
That's right. I wanted to have a character who is himself become gentrified. You know, he himself was a child who grew up in East Liberty, you know, in very blue-collar environments, and now has an office downtown near the University of Pittsburgh, wears a jacket and tie. He has an advanced degree. He has privileges at the hospital. He's so different from the world he came from, and yet his aunt will still say to him, you know, come on over for ziti on Sunday. I'm making my mother's sauce. I mean, so he's very caught up in that Italian-American uneasy bridge between the past and the present.
We've learned a lot about Daniel Rinaldi, through the course of your books in the last four that you've done. You've now written your fifth. Are you yourself still learning about Daniel Rinaldi as you write these?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, one of the things that made writing Head Wound so compelling is I not only learned more about Daniel Rinaldi, but I learned a lot more about his wife, Barbara. And we learn a lot about her from even when before she met Daniel. So I had an opportunity to talk about their marriage and their relationship and its ups and downs and what Barbara was like before she met Daniel. So I learned a lot that I actually didn't know I was going to learn. But the book is so rich with all that material, I think it's why it took so long. Plus, I wanted to do something I've never done before, which is we know who the villain is pretty early on, which is rare for me. We almost never do in my books. But I wanted to know who the villain was early on so that there could be a cat-and-mouse game between Daniel Rinaldi and this villain. And I think it works pretty well.
Whenever we see television shows, movies, or read books about therapists, we often see a situation where a therapist ends up going to a therapist. It's one of the things that therapists do. in writing these books, is this, in a way, your own therapy? Is it therapeutic for you to write these books as a therapist?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I do see a therapist. Most therapists do. But writing the books is very therapeutic for me. For one thing, I get to revisit Pittsburgh. My hero is an Italian-American with a beard who was raised in Pittsburgh and went to Pitt. Well, that's me. The only difference is he's a lot braver and more resourceful than I am, and he's a former amateur boxer. So I got to explore a lot of stuff that, you know, when you're a therapist, you pay attention mostly to the feelings and experiences of your patients. And my fantasy life, which used to be taken care of when I was a screenwriter, is now, I think, utilized in these books.
Well, I'm looking forward, as I said, to the latest one coming out. It's called Head Wounds. It's another Daniel Rinaldi story, mystery. I thank you very much, Dennis, for being on the program with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Peter. Thank you so much for having me.
Dennis Palumbo, author of Head Wounds. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the page for this program, which is show number 0442, and you'll find links to Dennis's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about celebrities and their political aspirations and or pronouncements and whether or not they should do that or not. Also, we'll speak to the author of Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. And we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, Sal's Pizza in Billerica, Massachusetts, got approval for a rebuild. As part of that project, a new 6-foot fence would be built. Arthur Lynch, the neighbor on the other side of the fence, was upset because the fence wasn't as high as the previous one and would allow people to look into his yard. Sal's Pizza agreed to install an 8-foot fence instead, but when the installation started, Lynch had a fit, throwing them off of his property, according to Billerica Building Commissioner Mark Lalumiere. Sal then decided that he would go with the permit and put up a 6-foot fence instead. Well, the 66-year-old Arthur Lynch responded by painting douchebag in giant letters on his barn facing Sal's. Town residents are trying to force Lynch to remove the word since it can be seen by everyone passing by. Legal experts, though, say it will be difficult to do that without violating Lynch's First Amendment rights. How about this? What if they put up a big fence to hide it from... We go from Massachusetts to the Sunshine State, where apparently in a similar situation, the First Amendment doesn't come into play. Two Florida homeowners owe thousands of dollars in fines for painting murals emulating a Vincent van Gogh masterpiece on the exterior of their home. The Mount Dora home is covered in blue and yellow paint swirled on the house and a perimeter wall in the style of Van Gogh's painting The Starry Night. The homeowners were fined $100 per day, but the fines were capped at 31 days. A magistrate lifted the cap on Thursday. Now that means the homeowners now owe over $8,000. The fines will continue until the murals are removed. Gee, I wonder what would happen if they just painted douchebag on the house. An employee who was fired from the Spanaway, Washington Walmart for allegedly trying to steal a safe returned to the store days later to try to retrieve what he had left in the safe, his drugs. On Sunday morning, the fired employee called the Walmart store and said that he was coming in to pick up a safe that he forgot at the store. Thinking this was suspicious, loss prevention employees opened the safe that the man had previously attempted to steal from the store, and inside they discovered a yellow container that held a stash of heroin and Xanax. Pierce County Sheriff's Department said that when the fired employee arrived at the Walmart, customer service asked him what was inside it, and he told them it was a yellow container that had his medication inside, so the employees called 911. When deputies arrived, the man started crying. He told the deputies the safe was his and the yellow container and narcotics were his. He went on to say that he paid $350 for them. The 24-year-old was booked into the Pierce County Jail for the unlawful possession of a controlled substance. You know, I still don't think he understands the gravity of his situation, and I have more questions about this story than answers. For instance, why did he try to steal the safe in the first place, as opposed to just taking his own illegal materials out of it? Also, why did he think that being fired would entitle him to come back to the store to ask for his stuff? And if we go back to the beginning, why put his drugs into their safe in the first place? I don't know. Anyway. We have one more Stuff File news story here in this segment before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A Facebook event calling for a candlelight vigil to remember a destroyed Taco Bell restaurant in Montgomery, Alabama, started as a joke. But according to the United Press International, about 100 people showed up on January 21st to pay their respects to the popular fast food restaurant, which burned to the ground on January 17th after electrical equipment sparked a fire. The owner promised to rebuild and, quote, have a true celebration upon its reopening, unquote. Sure, they say it was an electrical fire, but do we really know? Does anybody know where that chihuahua was? Does it have an alibi?
Yo quiero Taco Bell.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Should celebrities and CEOs tout their political viewpoints? According to reputation management specialist Ryan McCormick, the answer is no. Ryan is the co-founder of Goldman McCormick PR. He joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Peter. Pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Thanks for being on the program with us. And full disclosure, you and your PR firm have been instrumental in helping to book guests on this program, so I appreciate that.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having your guests, and it's a pleasure.
So I saw this little blurb that you talked about when you were talking about the CEOs and celebrities. You believe they should keep their political viewpoints to themselves. Why?
Absolutely. Because the moment you take a political stance, we're talking, I support this candidate or I support that candidate, what's going to happen is that you are going to provoke a person of the opposite mindset negatively. You're going to emotionally provoke them. And there are people who love the President of the United States. There are people who do not love the President of the United States. When you attack the President of the United States, you're polarizing on a deep, deep level a portion of that audience that will probably no longer want to do business with you. And it's such a shame, too, because you could have a superior product, and those people will not go and get your product because they feel upset. Their feelings have been hurt. They don't want to support anyone that supports an opposite consciousness of where they are, and it's a real shame. And I think that you have, as a CEO, especially, you have a responsibility to your customers and to your employees not to go that route ever under any circumstances.
Well, you know, we mentioned CEOs and celebrities, and they are really two different kettle of fish. And the reason why I bring that up is, I get the feeling that if a CEO does his or her job correctly, you don't hear about them at all.
Yes.
Celebrities are different. They are already in the public eye almost every move they make, from whatever they do as far as the talent is concerned to being in the public eye, at functions to even just going to do their own groceries, they're always being photographed and in the limelight. So it's a little different for them to hide that stuff, I guess they can say. But CEOs... Well, but
they can.
Yeah.
Yes, CEOs are in the back of it. As far as celebrities go, I mean, here's the thing. Yes, you are part of the limelight, and yes, people know your name. But if as a celebrity, you can also draw attention to a lot of worthy causes. If all these celebrities that are out there attacking the president were to also tweet about saying, hey, listen, we need to work on this cause, and this is an honorable charity, they'd be doing so much more good than they could by attacking the political candidates. And here's the thing, too. I don't think a lot of people really want to care. A lot of people don't care what celebrities think because they spend most of their days, you know, playing make-believe. Well, most people, they have to go to a job, and, you know, it's hard. But celebrities, they generally enjoy a different lifestyle than most people have. And I think that because of that, because they, you know, they have this, you know, lifestyle, I think they rub people the wrong way, especially when they push their beliefs upon others.
You mentioned a word earlier. You said polarized or polarization. Do you think part of the problem is with the idea of somebody coming out and touting their own viewpoint? Do you think part of the problem is the fact that because we now live in such a polarized society, that it becomes more of an issue? I mean, let's go back to the days of, say, the Vietnam War. That was certainly a polarizing situation. But you had people coming out on both sides of the spectrum talking about the war. It didn't necessarily affect their career. You had John Wayne going after Jane Fonda, and both of them could still put seats in the butts in the seats when it came to... You know, box office. So is it different now than it was then?
I think so. A couple of reasons. One, I think that the level of consciousness and intelligence of the American people has dropped so substantially. I don't even think, if you look at the millennial generation, forget about it. There's no hope. There's no hope. We're talking. We're basically that movie that came out in 2006 by Mike Judge called Idiocracy. That's actually become an official documentary right now. So I think that people get provoked so easily. So you don't have the critical thinking skills that I guess we once had. And also, when back then, Vietnam, it's like it was a war. It was a war that people were involved with, and I think that a lot of people didn't want to go to war, and I can see that there was a big, big issue. But now, today, people are getting provoked emotionally by candidates, and I think it's because they align their beliefs so closely with that of the candidate or the politician. So when you attack the politician, you feel like you're being attacked personally. And I think it's because that people maybe don't process their feelings and emotions in the same way they did before. They become much more irritated and irritated quickly. And the idea of having an intellectual discussion, it almost feels like it's non-existent, because when you are provoked emotionally, emotions seem to overcome logic. It's emotions first, then logic after. And when you're constantly provoked in a state of negative emotion, you're never going to get to logic. And I think that's where a lot of people are. I think a lot of people are in an emotional state. And when these CEOs or these celebrities, they go political, it's the worst thing they can do. Peter, if you are a CEO and you are a celebrity, you can affect millions of people and pull them to your cause so much greater if you just simply become successful, don't share your beliefs, and act like a good person. Be a nice, kind, compassionate person. You'd be amazed at how many people will want to look at your political beliefs knowing that you're not stuffing it upon other people. I mean, I think that's one of the greatest things you can do. Look at Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks is one of those people, I don't know what his political beliefs are, but he seems to be like the nicest guy in Hollywood. And who knows what his beliefs are, but he's nice, and I think that he's going about it the right way. He should be the example that people should follow.
Okay, so as you know, a lot of people will wrap themselves very quickly in the First Amendment. And you get a celebrity who would say, just because I am a celebrity doesn't mean I abdicate my right to speak out and speak my mind. What do you say to people about like that?
Well, sure. You have the right to do it. You absolutely do have the right to say it. You can do whatever you want to say it. But I'm thinking that for a long-term career goal, it's poison. It's really poison. And I have to say, quite frankly, a lot of these celebrities that are out there that are attacking any political candidate, the rights in America are being so rapidly diminished. You know, warrantless spying, drone use, all these things are happening, and they were not there speaking out there. They were supporting a presidential candidate or a political candidate that did the same exact thing that the current one is in. So I see a lot of hypocrisy there. So you know, they can believe and do whatever they want to do, I guess, for the time being. For the time being, I guess they can say and do whatever they want. But they have to know that by them being so politically active and being politically engaged, they're going to diminish their earning capabilities. They're going to diminish their capability of appealing to a maximum-sized audience. And if I am a head of a studio, I want to be able to buy talent and have talent that will maximize the greatest audience and to be the, you know, the best, biggest return possible. And if you keep on, if you're a celebrity and you keep on provoking people, whether even people agree with you or not, I think you're setting yourselves up for a colossal fall.
Okay, let me play devil's advocate here for a moment and a little bit of a catch-22. Your job as a reputation management specialist, your job as someone in PR is to help people get their word out, to promote them, and also to a certain degree be a little bit of a gatekeeper to protect them sometimes from themselves.
Yes.
Having said that, having said that, you have put out this press release talking about what celebrities and CEOs should or should not do as far as voicing their viewpoints. You then come on this program and you mentioned millennials.
Absolutely.
Where you feel society is going with millennials. Aren't you now doing exactly what you said they shouldn't do?
You're right. I have to say it, Peter. That's probably one of the most intelligent questions I've ever been asked by a radio host before, and I really thank you for calling me out on that. Yep, I actually did this. I just did exactly what I recommended people not to do, and I want to make myself as an example. Do not do what I just said. Yes, some people have different perspectives on millennials, but I should have pulled back and I should have said, you know what, whatever you come to. But I'm going to just say that from personal experience with the millennial generation, I've not been overly positive with it. But at the same time, I'm not attacking them. Oh, I don't know. They are their own generation, let's just say it that way. But I think you're going to provoke people much more if you go political. Political, you can provoke people in a negative way much quicker than by attacking any group, I think.
But having said that, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit. I find that a lot of people nowadays are just too sensitive, period. So it doesn't have to be political. It just has to be a different opinion of their own. It's not political. People turn things into political debates that really aren't.
Right. Well, this thing called overly sensitivity, and I don't know what it is, but anything that people are quote-unquote offended by, they are responding internally to external stimulation. And if you are in a perpetual state of fear and anxiety and you don't have the capability of processing life the way it is, unfortunately, you're probably going to be one of those people that's going to be provoked by everything else. And then what's the goal for that? What, do we have to shut down free speech in order for you not to be offended? And I think it's terrible. I do feel there was an era earlier in this country and earlier in the world where people could say what they wanted to say, and you didn't have to worry about people getting so upset. And I really feel that a lot of it has to do with maturity. It's about maturity, and it's about just, you know, everyone does their thing. As long as you don't infringe upon me, it'd be a nice thought to have, but I guess people are overly sensitive. They're upset when you have an opinion that's completely different to theirs, and the idea that you should limit your opinion in order not to offend them, I think that's awful. That is the death of free speech. That is the death of a functioning society.
Is social media making things worse?
Absolutely.
Particularly Twitter.
Oh, well, Twitter, because I feel social media, because people convey ideas in short bursts, and yes, you can simplify an idea, but you don't leave a lot of room for critical thinking. I think the face-to-face meetings and the phone calls are so much better to further along discussions and dialogues, but the idea of people on social media all the time, I think, you know, talking to a psychologist, I think it's hardwiring your brain in a different way. It's not allowing you to have the type of human experience that we're accustomed to having.
So as far as you're concerned, bottom line, celebrities and CEOs, follow the work, follow the ethic, leave the politics at home.
Right. Focus on doing a superior product. If you're a celebrity, you know, we're talking about, you know, what celebrities are, you know, very successful. The ones that we don't hear about. The ones who we respect for their acting talent. So, and the CEOs that we don't hear about. The ones that we respect for their, you know, talents at their job. So stay out of that. Don't even go near that. Just put out a superior product, be the best actor you can be, and believe me, people will respond to your political beliefs in a much more positive fashion, because you won't even have to say a word. They'll just look you up and they'll find out about you, and if they admire you, they'll probably want to emulate what you're doing.
Ryan, always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Ryan McCormick, co-founder of Goldman McCormick PR. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0442, and you'll find links to Ryan's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. With many of the nation's aging highways and bridges crumbling from neglect, the president has called for a major push to rebuild America's infrastructure. President Trump wants to invest $1.5 trillion, and he wants the approval process to take no more than 2 years. To understand how important this is, all we have to do is look at what happened with the Bayonne Bridge that connects New Jersey with Staten Island. Opened in 1931, it couldn't accommodate the taller ships that started being built after the Panama Canal was recently widened. Fortunately, an ingenious plan to raise the bridge was developed that would have virtually no environmental impact. Despite that, the bridge still got bogged down in red tape. The mandatory environmental review filled 20,000 pages. Let's be fair, all those delays meant that the bridge couldn't be completed until 10 years after planning began. Incredibly, that's the same amount of time it took the U.S. to complete the entire Panama Canal 100 years ago. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
You're listening to the Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. And more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program that is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. But I also want to bring up the point about my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with many Hollywood luminaries. Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer. Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner. Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar. A host of TV icons, plus two guys who left their footprints up on the moon. So order it now. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and for your e-reader on Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website, which is BearManorMedia.com. All the links are on our website at thestufffile.com, so buy the book. What are you waiting for? Okay, let's get back to the stuff. Now, here's a story with an interesting twist. A Florida pedophile plotted with his 80-year-old mom to assassinate the judge who jailed him. 56-year-old Robert Anthony O'Hare allegedly made a series of cryptic phone calls to his mom from prison where they talked about chatting to a man called the rabbi. The rabbi was apparently a 75-year-old hitman. They also passed numbers back and forth over the course of a year, which, when deciphered, spelled out Kill Briggs. That's the surname of the judge who jailed him. John Harrell of Lake County Sheriff's Office in Florida says, as far as the weird scale goes, this one is off the charts totally. Okay, now during a phone conversation with his mother, he passed along a set of numbers that ended up being a secret code that they would use to send messages back and forth. O'Hare, currently in jail for possessing child pornography and hiding a small camera in jukeboxes to record kids, now faces a solicitation to commit murder charge that could land him in jail for life. He has already been sentenced to 20 years on his pedophile charge. Investigators are also thinking of opening up a case against his elderly mom. Wow. Anybody feeling sorry for this guy? Anybody? Bueller? Anybody? Yeah, I didn't think so. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, talk about one heck of an explosive donation. Authorities say a grenade launcher loaded with a live grenade was left with other donated items at a Florida Goodwill store. The Manatee County Sheriff's Office says the store manager told deputies that the grenade launcher had come in a shipment from another store several days earlier. The employees at the other location said they sent it along because they didn't know what it was. Deputies say they disposed of the active grenade in a hazmat locker, and the launcher was stored in the agency's property room. It's not clear who donated the items. Seriously, why would someone donate a grenade launcher to Goodwill? for that matter, who has a grenade launcher to donate to Goodwill in the first place? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? February 7th will be the 151st anniversary of the birth of Laura Ingalls Wilder, the American writer best known for the Little House on the Prairie series of children's books. Thanks to the books, and of course the popular television series that was based on the characters, we know a lot about her work, but perhaps not a lot about the real Laura herself. Caroline Frazier is the author of Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Caroline joins us on the line from New Mexico. Hi, Caroline.
Hello. Good to be with you.
Thanks for being on the program with us. As I said in the introduction, we know a lot about the characters, but maybe not a lot about her. In putting this book together, what's the biggest thing we will learn about Laura Ingalls Wilder? And in doing your research, what's the biggest thing you learned about her?
Well, you know, Laura lived for a very long time, 90 years, and so her life covered a whole swath of American history. The books only take you up to the day that she got married at the age of 18. So I became very interested in the frontier history behind her life and wanted readers to know more about that because it's just fascinating and in many ways kind of a darker history and more dramatic even than the stories that she told. So, you know, the book looks at everything from the Plains Indian Wars to what was happening when she wrote the books decades later, the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl, and how those things connected to her earlier life. So I hope that, you know, readers of Prairie Fires come away with a much more complex and kind of nuanced view of her life and her work.
I'm willing to bet, too, that a lot of people would assume that because she has she wrote such popular books, that she was probably a very, very wealthy woman. But that was not necessarily the case, was it?
No, she lived most of her life in poverty. And in fact, a real motivating factor behind her sitting down and writing these books in her 60s at a moment when most people, you know, would have been retiring, you know, after a long, difficult farming life, the motivating factor was money. I mean, she really needed the money. And fortunately for her, the first book did quite well. And by the time she finished the series in 1943, they'd become very popular. So the books did make the last years of her life much more comfortable than they had been and really provided some security. But most of her life was lived in poverty. And you can really see, I think, more of the detail of the family struggle than you see in the books themselves. You know, she had a very strong idea of, you know, what was appropriate for children and what was not. And so she left a lot of stuff out of the books because she really wanted to sort of idealize her childhood and her parents and memorialize them. So she really left a lot of things out. And it's interesting to see how difficult life was for them economically.
Would you say that in writing this book, you not only share the story of Laura Ingalls Wilder, but you also share the story of the times of which she wrote and the times that she lived in?
Yes, I think that those years and those experiences, the whole experience of frontier settlement is so important to Americans, because I think we have tended to idealize this whole period of our history, how you see this in Hollywood movies. You certainly see it in the television show based on Little House on the Prairie. And I think it's really important for us to go back and examine this whole period of our history and question some of the myths that have been built up about it, not least by Little House on the Prairie. because we have this idea that homesteading was a complete success. That's not, in fact, true. And almost half of the people who tried to do it ended up washing out, much the way that Charles Ingalls and Almanzo Wilder, Wilder's husband, did. You know, they did prove up on their land, but they couldn't hold on to it. And so I think if we go back and look at why those things happened and why life was so tough for small farmers and continues to be today, we would know a little bit more about the kinds of struggles we're having now with climate change. I mean, those are not new. You know, she experienced them directly in her own life by trying to farm on the Great Plains, which is not ideally suited to farming without irrigation. So I think I found the history really fascinating to learn more about, and I hope readers of Prairie Fires do as well.
Of course, she never lived long enough to, I mean, that would be impossible, but she never lived long enough to see the success of the television show and all that that generated. But as you mentioned earlier, she did get to see some of the success later in life of what her books meant to people. How big of a success was it by the time of her death? How much of that success did she get to witness?
Well, she certainly received a lot of accolades from librarians, began naming branch libraries for her, and she began to receive awards. And she did die a fairly wealthy woman, not wealth as we would define it now, perhaps, but certainly relatively wealthy compared to her earlier life. So she probably was one of the richest people in her town, for example, and had a car and loved to go out to eat at restaurants, because what a luxury that must have been for somebody who had been farming all her life and preparing her own meals and meals for her family all her life. So I think she was very comfortable. She, you know, wasn't living in a mansion or something like that. She continued to live the same kind of life, pretty much, that she had always lived in her farmhouse. But she was certainly, I think, felt the security of knowing that what she had couldn't be taken away from her, as it had been in previous parts of her life.
So do you think she was content with the legacy that she was leaving behind? She must have been aware, especially later in life, the kind of impact that she had.
Yes, I think she was very content with that and very pleased to see and surprised, you know, to see the reception of the book. She told interviewers this, you know, that she never expected that they would be as successful as they were. I think she probably would not have been pleased by the television show because she was very protective of her her family's legacy and her, especially her father. You know, she very much wanted to present an image of him that was drawn for her from her feelings. You know, she really he was a beloved person to her, and I think she would have been quite startled and dismayed,
even
at
though
the image on TV,
even though the image of Charles Ingalls as portrayed by Michael Landon was such a positive one.
I think it was positive according to his lights. I think when you look at it now, it seems to be a show that's largely about the 1970s and about his image of himself, perhaps a sort of a vainglorious image, if I may say so. And so I don't think she would have been pleased at the liberties that he took with their life story, which were quite astonishing in many respects.
The book is called Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. It's written by Caroline Fraser. And Caroline, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, thanks for having me. It was good to talk to you.
Caroline Fraser, the author of Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0442, and you'll find links to Caroline's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
A Clackamas, Oregon man has recently pleaded guilty to placing calls to airports in Nevada and Texas, reporting his father and brother as terrorists because they got an invitation to a family wedding and he didn't. 38-year-old Sonny Donnie Smith admitted to placing anonymous phone calls to security offices at McCarran International Airport in Las Vegas and the Midland International Airport and Spaceport in Midland, Texas. Assistant U.S. Attorney Hannah Horsley said the calls were made September 3, 2016. The calls prompted an FBI investigation that revealed no terrorist threats. Smith's father and brother were detained and questioned by investigators, and the brother missed his flight. Okay, this one leads to several questions, but they all have the same answer. Just how petty of a person are you that you would call authorities to tell them your father and your brother are terrorists? Why are you blaming your father and brother because they got a wedding invitation that you didn't? What revenge were you planning for the actual wedding couple? And why did you actually think that you could get away with sending an anonymous message to the cops like this? All questions point to one answer and one answer only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0442. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0442. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Any rebroadcast of this copywritten program in whole or in part without the express written consent of, oh God, who the hell are we kidding? Who's going to steal this show? God, who writes this stuff? Holder, what a kidder.